From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. This week's Republican National Convention is about as extreme, nonsensical, terrifying, and lie-filled as one might expect after nearly 4 years of Donald Trump in the White House. Ahead of the convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, the Republican Party announced it wouldn't even bother with adopting a platform and would simply confirm that it was embracing Trump's agenda. The themes of the convention so far appear to be that Trump defeated the coronavirus and that a Joe Biden presidency would bring a socialist dystopia and racial unrest and destroy American suburbs. Meanwhile, the list of anti-Trump Republicans is slowly growing, with former RNC chair Michael Steele announcing that he was joining the Lincoln Project, a group that has been organizing conservatives against the president's re-election. My guest is Jeet Heer. He is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. Welcome to the program, Jeet.
Good to be here.
I sort of was at a loss for words in watching the first day of the RNC. It's hard to describe what is unfolding on the national stage. It's hard to accept that this is the state of American politics on the conservative end of the spectrum. And then Kimberly Guilfoyle, the Fox News commentator who was once a prosecutor and former wife of California Governor Gavin Newsom, spoke and gave a rally speech that basically had the hallmarks of a radical right-wing extremist dictatorial fantasies. What was your general opinion and an impression of what we've seen so far of the RNC?
Yeah, I think that the what you said is right. And I think one way to think about it is that the Trump is at a position where he really needs to keep his base and hold on to the people he already has. And he's not in a position to do much outreach, although there was some efforts, but not a lot. And I think that really shows the sort of, you know, persistent weakness that he's had, which we've seen in the polling. In some ways he's higher than one would expect given the state of the economy and the pandemic, but he has held on to his base, but he's only done that at the cost of really throwing a lot of red meat, which will prevent him from reaching a broader audience. So I think that's a kind of trap that Trump seems to be in right now, that he has to really shore up his base in a way that alienates everyone else.
The lies were coming thick and fast on Monday, perhaps the biggest one being how Trump has tackled the coronavirus pandemic. What did you see in terms of the kinds of claims? It's hard to imagine that there is a way to easily justify what Trump has done over the last, over the first half of this year. We're approaching nearly 180,000 Americans dying from the coronavirus. Our rate of infection and death far surpasses any other nation in the world. How did the RNC's speakers and Trump himself address this issue?
Well, I think you summed it up perfectly. I think there's just a general sense that, well, he handled it well. I mean, I think that's what Donald Trump Jr. said, and others have said that, like, the virus is a China virus. It came through threat in America. He ordered the shutdown from China, which the Democrats resisted. Then he mobilized. And of course, this is all like kind of lies, but it's the only story that he has. I think the real danger is that, and we see this out in the world, that Trump supporters will believe this and think coronavirus is over and done with. And we know that his supporters are much less likely to wear masks or practice social distancing and often resist doing so. So there's a way in which it's not just lies, but these are lies with real world consequences, which will prolong the virus.
What's been really interesting, which hasn't received as much attention, is that the RNC is carrying on somewhat in person in Charlotte, North Carolina, unlike the Democratic National Convention last week that was held almost entirely online. And the way in which the Republicans are tackling the gathering of a few hundred delegates is by using a very systematic form of testing. And they're using an app to do basically contact contact tracing, which are exactly the tools that one would have hoped a president would have deployed on a nationwide level if he actually cared about Americans. But Republicans are using this. This is also what the White House uses to keep the president safe. But these are not tools that are apparently available to Americans at large.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, yeah, I think the cynicism is overwhelming. And one sees this, has seen this a lot in a pandemic, of this sort of ruling class people who are like quite protected and can practice social distancing just because it's like they're in their mansions in the Hamptons, but they want everyone else to be out working, essential workers in very dangerous conditions. So yeah, it's a very cynical thing, all the worse because they know what they're doing. And they know what they're like calling on other people, the risks that they're forcing on other people. So, I mean, I think that this is, if Trump loses, I think this will be the major reason that the corona message has not been consistent. And I think that there's enough people that can see through it. Not a huge number of people, but he still has that 40%, 42% Republican base. But the more marginal voters, I think, he has really lost.
So he is also claiming that he's going to be, and his supporters are claiming that they're going to be saving America from the socialist nightmare that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are apparently heralding in. In fact, Senator Tim Scott, the only Black Republican in the Senate, even, I don't know if he meant to say this, but he basically said that there would be a socialist utopia that would be unleashed if Biden and Harris were to be in the White House. He maybe forgot what the word utopia means, but a socialist utopia sounds real nice. I wish Biden and Harris were promising such a thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it almost seems like they're expecting Bernie Sanders to win. And when Biden won, they've just decided we'll run the same campaign anyways. And yeah, yeah, I mean, obviously it's particularly ridiculous given the campaign he's running and who Biden is. I mean, I think it also speaks to the problems that they've had in kind of coming up with good opposition research on Biden, things that they can really use to get him down. So again, I mean, yeah, it doesn't seem like a very coherent, and but again, a message that really resonates with the Republican base, with the people who are already very pro-Trump, but doesn't register beyond that. I feel like with the marginal voters who are like sort of cross purposes or swing voters, I don't see a lot that they offered him. I think that's basically the problem. There's not a lot of engagement with Biden as Biden, or showing why Biden can't, it would be wrong. And the very fact that they're created a caricature that looks nothing like Biden, I think makes their case much harder.
The claim that Donald Trump Jr. made about the perfect life that Americans could have if they voted for Trump was particularly interesting. He repeated over and over again that the happiness and opportunities that would be afforded to all Americans if Trump were to only win a second term. He failed to mention that Trump has been in power for nearly 4 years and nowhere to be seen as this perfection that he is promising.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think he did sort of start off by saying that, well, just think about a few months ago when everything was going well and the argument was that things were better than ever until the virus came along.
Apparently we had perfection in January, we just didn't know it.
Exactly. That was the moment of perfection. So and in some ways his whole pattern about the perfect life seemed like reminiscent of the famous Talking Heads song, you know, like you may think you have this beautiful life in this beautiful suburb, which is a kind of connotation that I don't think helps him. But I mean, his own speech was very bizarre, with the kind of very frantic, speaking far too fast, speaking the way I'm speaking,
right.
And the weird eye movement,
Yeah,
and the
his
water
eyes were
coming.
tearing up. I know people on social media made a big deal about this, that he looked like he was on cocaine. Obviously all speculation.
Donald Trump Jr. started training at the same time, but I actually want to defend Donald Trump Jr. I don't know. We have no evidence that there was any illicit substance. I think that it's a more existential issue with him. He, more than any of the other Trump kids, has tied his fate to his father, and there's evidence that like he kind of has this emotional need to prove himself with his father. But he was much more involved with the Russia gate than anyone else. He had set up that meeting at Trump Tower. And the New York Times had these interviews indicating that he thinks like if his father loses, there'll be he and his father will be in serious legal jeopardy. And so I think that there's a desperation and fear that you see in his eyes and in his mannerisms, which is really unique. And also, I have to say, in his girlfriend's eyes and
That and
mannerisms
that's
too.
Kimberly Guilfoyle, the person we were referring to earlier. And you were mentioning the New York Times article, which investigated and spoke to anonymous sources, one of whom said that Trump Jr., Donald Trump Jr., was very fearful of losing, and that once if they if him and Trump ha if the Trumps had to leave the White House, that they would be in serious legal trouble, and they're basically are on the verge of being prosecuted in numerous ways over numerous issues that they may be immune from now while they're in the White House, but certainly won't be immune from once they leave the White House. And there's also the Senate report, a bipartisan report on the Russian interference campaign of 2016, which also again clearly linked Donald Trump Jr., Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, in a way that is even more clear than the Mueller report did. Of course, none of that entered the rhetoric at the RNC.
No, but I think that if one keeps that all in mind, Trump Jr.'s behavior, his mannerisms, his desperation all make much more sense.
The McCloskeys, the white couple from Missouri who became internet famous for casually wielding their weapons at protesters that were passing through their housing complex, were also featured speakers at the RNC day one on Monday. And they seem to be symbolic of exactly the kind of voter that Trump is looking at, right? These upper middle class white conservatives, gun owning conservatives, who are trusting Trump to keep all the undesirables out of the suburbs, out of where they live. And their speech seemed to veer so close into this kind of territory of, they practically all but said Trump's going to keep all the black and brown people out of your neighborhoods.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. I think that is a big part of Trump's argument or appeal. He constantly talks about the suburbs and how he'll protect. And that
But Nikki
undercuts the
Haley
other.
says there's no racism in the United States.
Well, exactly. That undercuts the other part because they had Nikki Haley and Tim Scott who are like trying to reassure people that the GOP is not racist. And also even beyond that, I mean, there is a genuine effort to try to reach people of color. With like Scott, like quite pointing out some aspects of Joe Biden's legacy, but there's no way that like Biden, whatever his problems, is he like worse than the party that would have the McCloskeys? I don't think so. So there's a way in which there's a lot of like messages that were at odds with each other.
Yeah, one could summarize it saying Joe Biden is not an anti-racist. Donald Trump is an overt racist. Then there was also, so I want to bring up what Nikki Haley said and also a preview of what Pompeo is expected to say Tuesday. Nikki Haley was the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations before she was South Carolina governor. And the description that she gave of the United Nations was quite bizarre. She said this was an institution that was filled with dictators, murderers, and thieves. But of course, Trump's closest allies on the international stage would fit that description that she gave.
Saudi Arabia, among other nations that Trump is like closely allied with, the leadership of those countries is definitely fits that description. I have to say with that, though, like we have to say that American politicians have long try to gain advantage by attacking the UN. And it's a bipartisan thing. I mean, Daniel Patrick Moynihan did the same thing in the 70s. And more recently, you know, Susan Rice, Trump's, Barack Obama's foreign policy advisor, she said the UN was like the cantina in Star Wars. Unfortunately, this sort of, you know, xenophobia is bipartisan. But certainly that's what she's trying to do. She's trying to leverage her time in the UN to make an appeal to the sort of GOP nativist base. But also reinforcing that message that, you know, Trump will protect us from these, you know, horrible others, be they foreign countries or dark-skinned people within the United States.
And then Mike Pompeo, State Secretary, is going to be addressing the RNC with a taped address from Jerusalem. This is a very interesting aspect of the RNC. State secretaries generally never speak at political conventions. They are supposed to remain, like defense secretaries, for example, they're supposed to remain above the political fray because they're supposed to be nonpartisan, even if they are, of course, appointed by a president from a particular party. And just a few weeks ago, Pompeo's office sent out a memo that is a very normal, typical thing that gets sent out apparently to diplomatic outposts of the United States, saying that people involved in the State Department, working for the State Department, should avoid getting involved in partisan politics ahead of the election. But he's addressing the RNC, and he's doing it from Jerusalem. We know where he stands on the issue of Israel and Palestine. How significant is this?
Oh, very significant on a number of counts. I mean, obviously, it's a violation of longstanding norms and very important.
And a Hatch Act violation, some people.
Yeah, exactly. The Hatch Act, but also, like, underlying all this is he's a Secretary of State of the United States. He's supposed to represent the whole country, he's not supposed to represent a political party. And then when he represents America, he represents it to the world and not a party. And then he's doing it in Jerusalem, which again is taking a kind of sides, but also he's bolstering his own presidential prospects. Like, he's doing this to launch his own campaign if Trump loses in 2024. And as Trump himself said, though, this is all aimed at American evangelicals. You know, like he said that it's the American evangelicals who care about Jerusalem, which is true, which I think like a further violation, because you're making a kind of sectarian foreign policy, a foreign policy for people who have a particular apocalyptic view of the significance of Jerusalem, that, like, you know, other Christians, let alone Jews or Muslims or non-believers, don't share. So it's very disturbing on a host of levels.
And at the same time as the RNC is taking place, and even the DNC took place last week, Israel has been bombing Gaza. The Israeli Defense Forces have been lobbing bombs at Gaza. There's been very little coverage of this issue. And it'll be really interesting to see how Pompeo, of course, turns the table, takes a page out of George Orwell's 1984 and paints Israelis as victims of Palestinians. And the whole Trump institution has basically been that, right? Up is down, right is wrong, day is night, left is right. In Trump's America, what we are seeing unfold before us as reality is not what he is presenting to his base. His base will believe the exact opposite, which is what he's offering them, that everything is fine and that it will continue to be fine if he remains president. It's just really shocking and really, you know, I'm wondering if you are filled with despair like I am, and maybe many other Americans are, watching this display of authoritarianism at the RNC.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's very little good things to say. I think maybe the one ray of hope is, I'm not sure it is resonating. The ratings for both conventions aren't great, but it's like, you know, 11.5 million for the RNC is 14.5 for the DNC, so about a quarter more. I think that there's a real disengagement of the American people from this politics, which is, you know, perhaps the not a bad thing.
So, finally, what do you think is going to emerge over the rest of the RNC? Trump is speaking on every night of the RNC, which is also unusual. He's also going to be delivering his nomination acceptance speech from the White House, which, similar to Mike Pompeo, seems to be an utter ethical violation, a blurring of lines between governance and partisan politics. I imagine that we're basically going to get what we got on day one of the RNC times four.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the larger issue is that there's a merging of Trump with the party, the sort of Trumpification of the GOP. Trump is the party. The party is Trump. They won't even have like a platform. They'll just have 50 bullet points from Trump. So the Republican Party stands for now for nothing but Trump. And again, the silver lining of this is that Trump is unpopular enough that the Republican Party will sink or swim with Trump, and hopefully sink.
Really interesting that Michael Steele joined the Lincoln Project. This is the former chair of the RNC, and some people are suggesting that the way in which the Republican Party has been pushed into Trump's arms, we now basically have three groupings. You have the fascist party, the Republican Party, which used to be the Democratic Party, and everybody else, progressives
That's right.
maybe.
Yeah, I think that's the exact formulation. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jeet, for joining us today. The Nation's website is the best place to read your writings on these matters.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. You'll find many articles I've written there.
That's thenation.com. Thanks so much, Jeet.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
My guest is Jeet here. He is the National Affairs Correspondent at The Nation. We've been discussing day one of the Republican National Convention. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.